All right, we're back on Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Robert Winters.
I'm Patrick Barrett, still.
Yeah, still. And just a few quick wrap-up things about election-related things. One thing I think it was kind of worth noting is that unlike 2017, where there were glitches and people like me had to kind of ramble on all the way up until close to 2 in the morning.
Glitches, like a hanging chance?
Like, you know, back then, it was the last hurrah for the old scanners. Yeah. They had to rescan multiple precincts and everything got delayed and delayed and delayed.
As opposed to these great new scanners that ate my ballot and I'd be put into a weird box.
So the great thing is that once all the data was brought into the senior center, it was remarkably fast how quickly it turned it around.
They come back fast.
You know, I mean, people used to say, well, when are you going to have results? You're going to have them by such and such an hour. And I would say, you'll be lucky if you ever get them by 11.
Well, right.
We got them by 11. The polls closed at 8. There was still stuff coming from the polls until, you know, for another hour or so. And we actually had everything all in the bag. We were closing down the election night broadcast at 11 o'clock, which was early.
Yeah, I remember running from my house down the street to the senior center, which I don't normally do, to see how the results came out. I think there was one sour, grapey group there that asked me if my money was well spent on counselors.
Patrick is an evil developer.
Which I smiled, and that was about it. But, I'm going to teach people how to make friends someday, and it'll be a free class.
Be kind of a nice thing to consider. Everybody should consider that for the next 2 years. A little good humor. It won't kill you, I promise. Yeah. But anyway, that was quick. The other thing that was worth noting with the new machines was that there were delays at the polls. Mm-hmm. And unlike the old one where you just drop your ballot in, it just went and away it goes, right? The new one actually is doing like a whole ballot scan before it can interpret what's on it. So it was taken anywhere from 15 seconds to a half a minute per ballot. And every voter got two ballots, one for council, one for school committee. So during rush hour, there was lines developing, and people were saying, I got to go to work.
I want to say one personal public service announcement about that, about the election. I went to the city hall to vote, which is where my polling is, and I saw a fellow with a sign, hand-painted, kind of looked like he walked off the set of Duck Dynasty, that said, Sneaky Siddiqui, you sold us down the creek. Screw you. You suck. And she topped the ticket.
Yeah.
That's all.
That's right. We could do with a little less of that type of politicking on election day. It's true, right? But anyway, we went smoothly. The CCTV crew did a great job.
Flesh moon!
Doing it all smoothly. Everything was wonderful. And hopefully by this Friday, if all goes well, I usually traditionally will get access to the ballot data. So if anybody has questions about, who got the most number two votes behind Sumble Siddiqui, or, how many ballots, what percentage of ballots was so-and-so named on, who's the sort of the ultimate popular candidate, whatever. Those are the types of things you can ask, but only when you have the ballot data. You can't really tell it just in the transfer reports. So hopefully by next week, if all goes well, we'll be able to sort of do that stuff and have a little fun with it.
And I think if anything, it's a whole new ball game with candidates. You got a lot of same faces, a couple of new ones, but all in all, they're all great people, and I think they actually should be pretty productive. At least they had the opportunity to be.
I think that's exactly right. So anyway. Moving away from elections a little bit, even though people are still, I should always say that it takes about 3 milliseconds after the election results are done before people start speculating as to, well, who do you think is going to be the next mayor? So people are doing that. Honestly, you don't have a vote in this. There are 9 people who are going to choose their chair. And that's what the mayor is the chair of the city council.
The president.
It's just like in Boston, we would call it the city council president, and that's really what matters. And they have a right to choose their chair, and they will. I mean, yes, that person will also become chair of the school committee, mm-hmm. which maybe should concern some voters who feel that that's an important criteria.
They should factor into the person who wants to launch off and buy for mayor. You know, you should be able to understand that's another a big role you're going to play.
Right.
And you're going to see me there a lot more than you're going to see me at the Sullivan Chamber now that I got kids in the school system.
Right. You know, and by the way, being the most popular in an election doesn't guarantee you to be going to be mayor. Mm-hmm. There were actually multiple elections where the person who was the last one elected wanted to get the boost from being mayor and then managed to get the votes in order to do that. That's happened in multiple occasions. So, you know, you can't make any determinations just on popularity and number one votes or order of election or anything really. You know, just do what's best for the city. That's the only thing that should really matter.
Yeah.
Now, there are some other interesting things that are kind of, you know, bubbling up around town, whether it's at the state legislature. People are, you know, saying, oh, you know, renters matter and we're going to be bringing back rent control and blah, 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 blah. We have locally, we have some new zoning petitions. There's one. Actually, that you played a hand in.
Surely not.
Surely? Don't call me Shirley.
yes, there's the Harvard Square zoning petition, which I had been working on at the behest of Suzanne Blier and the Harvard Square Neighborhood Association, John D. Giovanni and the Harvard Square Business Association. And Harvard was brought in for good measure, where I think in a very different role from me, I've acted more as a scribe than I did as somebody who was sort of pushing an agenda similar to what I did in Central Square. But, you know, in Harvard Square, I've often said, ew, why would I go to Harvard Square? But I think they all kind of like saw the work we did in Central and said, wow, you and Nancy Ryan sat in a room and didn't punch each other's brains out for 5 minutes. How did that happen? Can you help us with that? And that's more what I did. I was more of like a referee than I was anything else. And I just translated what I thought that they were looking for into zoning language.
Well, but that's an important role. I mean, the person who writes it is still the person who knows the language, right?
Yeah.
You know, you don't want, I mean, I've seen my share of shabbily written zoning petitions. Yes. You seem to know how to use English words.
I'm a good Englisher. you know, there's not a lot of magic to it. I think you want to try to make it as clear as possible, make sure that you have it enumerated correctly, and that my background in construction, I think, helps a little bit in terms of understanding what's actually achievable versus what's more aspirational in zoning. And also, a lot of these groups give you, I actually just got one from another group, like a whole laundry list of things they want to have happen. None of it's zoning. So you kind of have to either be the bearer of bad news or sort of just be the pragmatist and say, well, if you want sunshine and rainbows, we can't really zone for that, but I could make it so that, you know, that might be a likely outcome through another process.
So what are some of the if you could reduce to this latest zoning petition, and mm-hmm. by the way, my personal feeling about zoning petitions now, is like it was years ago. I'm come all full circle, is that zoning petitions should not be kind of recreating the world or tearing it asunder. It should be a little more incremental and with the understanding that if we do this now, maybe a couple of years from now we'll do something else, whatever. So what are some of the features of this particular initiative?
What I told these groups right off the bat was that if any of them protest or if any of them give me any or bring any nonsense to the planning board or the ordinance committee, I just won't do it, and I'll stand up and walk out. Right. The tenets of this petition in particular is it's more of a holistic approach to Harvard Square and reinstating previous conditions. It's not reinventing anything. There's some weird anomalies in Harvard Square zoning, like it's the only square that favors business and commercial uses over residential. I didn't tip the scale either way. I just brought residential up from a 3 FAR to a 4, just like it is for commercial.
Right. Now, is that similar to what happened with the Central Square restoration petition?
In Central Square, we did something a little bit more creative where we allowed for the FAR calculation in the building, be it commercial or residential, be combined and to reach that 4. So it gives you a little bit of flexibility for existing buildings, because Central Square was sold primarily as this is for existing buildings. It doesn't really spur new building construction, even though we do have one permit pulled under that zoning that is new construction. That was not the intent. Right. I like modest zoning changes. I don't like radical ones. Because I think what happens is people overblow them. They have one sort of nugget, I'll call it, in the Harvard Square petition that is a little bit scary. And, yeah, I know. Just buckle up. Halloween's over. It's an FAR.
Floor area ratio.
A floor area ratio bump for buildings that's almost unlimited by a special permit.
So this is Leland Chung will finally get his 500,000-foot tower?
Unfortunately, no, Leland, you will not, because we have a 60-foot height limitation in Harvard Square with an 80-foot extension of that by special permit. The height does not change. So, you know, the height of a building with a 4 FAR, let's say, is here, and the height of a building with a 10 billion FAR is also here, because we can't break that ceiling of height. If you were to change the height to infinity, then you would also be able to max that out. But that's not what we're talking about. Mm. I've already had a couple of emails from some people concerned about that one particular point. And the reason why it exists is to allow for some flexibility in infill development. I didn't want to put a number on the FAR because I wanted that to be up to this the special permit granting board. And also to follow the guidelines of the conservation district, which Charlie Sullivan has been working on for 2 years, which is originally how I got brought into this process. Right. So you have to follow those guidelines. You also have to follow the historic district guidelines, and then you also have to follow the zoning guidelines. So in Harvard Square, unlike any other place in Cambridge, there are three flaming legislative hoops that you have to jump through to get to go. So I felt comfortable with that being in place, that the amount of shenanigans that will play out are very, very limited. But what I wanted to not have happen was for a developer to say, I've got a 4 FAR maxed out. I'd like to go to 5, and I can on this lot, but it's really a 5.3 or it's a 5.4, and I give the FAR bump as a 1 or a half, and it never quite works out. When you apply a number in zoning, invariably someone's going to want to go around it or under it or behind it. It doesn't really work the way you think it should work. An FAR, just so people understand, is not really how most planners like to think in terms of development. FAR is more of a real estate construct. We put that number out there so that real estate speculators and real estate agents and brokers could give you sort of a future value of the property.
Right.
So that a property with an FAR of 1 is somewhat more predictable than an FAR of 4, but we know, relatively speaking, where you're going to go.
So is there any anticipation, like if this were to breeze through, and when's its first hearing? Is it coming
to the planning board next week? So November 19th, live at the planning board.
Right, and I think it doesn't come in front of the ordinance committee
until December 11th.
Right. But the thing is, if it were to go through, so what kind of differences might happen? Would you see more, like, just for example, like if you go over where Felipe's, or there's a one-story block over right by Brattle Square, could that go up under this?
So that block could go up now. There's nothing to stop that block from going up today under the current zoning. What I'm trying to do, and something similar we did in Central Square, which a few buildings are now taking advantage of, is of trying to address the biggest complaints I heard from the both groups was that the retail component of Harvard Square is dying, and which is in part true. But that the overall feel of Harvard Square has changed dramatically, and it's not just that we lost the pit or, you know, Mark McGovern no longer has a mohawk. It's more like
real estate values went right up with that.
Well, as they tend to do. But I think there's a little bit of nostalgia that rosy, you know, rose-colored glass kind of thing effect with that.
Yeah.
But the bigger changes. Similar to Central Square, I create an exemption for small footprint retail. The idea being is to shift the mentality and economics of the buildings where we have to make our $150 to $200 a foot on that ground floor to justify the value of the building, kind of like the Regency model. To let's chop it up, let's get more uses on that ground floor, make it a little more active, and then take that existing GFA, the gross floor area that we would have calculated at that base, and put it upstairs. I did something very similar in Central Square, and we have four projects using that right now that have Mass and Main is another one, that would be the fifth. And I used it when I built out a French bakery and Toscanini's ice cream. That space is exempted, and now I have the ability to add things like a rooftop bar to my building and restaurant, which I think inarguably is a positive.
Well, especially if you get me a few beers.
Especially. Right. The other big tweak is we got rid of the parking buyout requirement. Right. There was a caveat in Harvard Square and Central Square, the only places that do this, where you sort of pay to play when it comes to reduction in parking. We allow the parking to go down to zero. You don't need to do it. There's no place to put it anyway. And if you're repurposing an existing building, you know, you're not going to dig up JFK Street and go underneath it to put parking. And just no one's doing that. Plus, if the goal is to preserve the character and feel of the area, you're going to have to make some concessions. I'm actually quite proud of both groups. I think they behaved very well. And what they came out with, you know, if you're ABC, you're like, this doesn't really do anything. And I'm like, take it easy. It does some things. It's more of a quality of life. It gives you more flexibility than you had yesterday. And isn't that a better foundation to build off of than what you have now? And if you're the sort of the anti-group, you know, this, none of this is terrifying. You know, we're not changing the height, so we don't have to really worry about knocking buildings down. It's more of a rejiggering of old buildings where it's feasible.
You know, I mean, just thinking optimistically here, I kind of would mind seeing some of these ideas go a little bit more citywide. Was, you know, during the election season, you know, there was a lot of people saying, like, we need more density packet, you know, denser, taller, more. Yeah. And then some people going, hold on. And I think that there is a definable ideal that people maybe could actually rally around, mm-hmm. you know, which basically says we like density,
yep.
but we don't necessarily want unlimited density. We like, we're okay with height, but we care where the height is,
yep.
right? You know, so that in places like Harvard Square and Central Square, you know, you might want
to. Well, the problem right now is the argument has been reduced to if you like density and you want height in a neighborhood like West Cambridge, you're awesome. And if you don't like height and you don't like density in a place like West Cambridge, you're a racist.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to argue with the person across the aisle from you if that's the only position you can take.
Right. I've kind of come to the conclusion that I don't like NIMBYs or YIMBYs.
No, I think anyone who self applies a label like that is in themselves inside a box.
Right.
Exactly. You know, I think there's a natural.
There are definable good outcomes, and yeah. I think people need to actually just think about it with all the nuance.
The city has a natural predilection to grow, and it's going to continue to do that.
Yeah.
I think there are lots of places you can look to spur that future growth. That aren't really controversial at all, and that you could probably get lots of consensus around. And why not use that as the launch pad for your other sort of grandiose schemes of taking existing triple-decker neighborhoods, knocking them down and building quadruple-decker neighborhoods, which makes absolutely no pragmatic development sense whatsoever.
Right.
Or taking areas that have single-family houses that, you know, Charlie Sullivan's going to want to have a few words about, especially if they're these, you know, glorious mansion type places. And I'm not saying that those should exist. I think if anything, the best medicine for the Res A and Res B districts is probably a zoning petition that allows for the creation of multifamily units in those areas. Within like a C1-ish dimensional requirement.
Yeah, I always think in terms of unintended consequences. Like I actually fully support having allowing multifamily housing in what are currently single-family only zones.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, if you play that out into the future, into the long future, every time a single-family home would sell, you could imagine somebody buying it and turning it into multifamily, and then eventually one day there's no single-family homes. I kind of like having options for everybody.
I don't disagree, you know? But I think I like to let the market kind of do its thing sometimes.
Yeah.
I think that
if
it makes sense financially to go and buy a $16 million home from Alan Dershowitz and turn it into a four-unit apartment building, then God bless. Right now, it doesn't. That was kind of my biggest sort of concern about the overlay, was I didn't want a bunch of happy-go-lucky yahoos patting themselves on the back saying, you know, we solved for housing because we did this. But not only that, we solved for equity. And I was like, that's where I disagree. Like, you're not going to put, you know, financially, it never made any sense to go buy those lots and then slap a four-decker or knock down what's there and build something behind it. You know, there's so many other places right now that people are buying up to build that they're not even looking at those areas. So, like, I'm not sure why the focus was there. I get it politically. It's a fun thing to say. Right. And no one loves making West Cambridge people squirm more than me. Just kidding. Pat Barrett, 2021. But, you know, Central Square, I keep hammering on it. We had this figured out 7 years ago, ding-dongs. Yeah. We did C2. Look it up. The zoning's already done. The zoning is done. Not just the happy-go-lucky, you know, kids in the park nonsense. The zoning is done. You could take that, bring it to the clerk's office, pay the $150. Robert Winters is glad to pay it, and file that petition.
I have my checkbook right here.
But it's Central Square is a great place to put hype. It is.
Now, honestly, if we could actually begin the next 2 year cycle and so on, by filling out some of the missing pieces of Central Square, make it better. Which means a little bigger, doesn't mean everything, you know, which means a bit bigger.
But think about places like along Webster Street in Columbia, where you go into Union Square.
Absolutely.
It's all junkyards. They're all selling their lots, and they're being forced to build 35-foot-tall, 8-unit, stupid-looking things. Those buildings should be 120 feet tall, going into Boynton Yards, or even taller than that, going into Boynton Yards, which is going to be 24 stories.
And I'll point out that, in fact, Union Square is pretty soon going to become a Green Line station. Maybe trolley lines.
Isn't that what those people talk about? Transit-oriented, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I find perplexing as hell, is that we used to hear people talk about transit-oriented development. Even in the old days, the ABC crowd used to do that. And then it all became subsumed by overlay talk and whatever, you know. Can we just kind of get back to some basic planning principles here? You know, the truth is that, you know, Union Square Station is going to be in Somerville, but the thing is it's right next to Cambridge, so that means that's a good opportunity to take an area which is kind of a little on the shaky side anyway, and turn it into something pretty amazing.
CDD these days seems to be like a never-ending, like, hold-my-beer meme, where, like, you know, we had C2 done, it was really good, and we abandoned it, even though we said it's part of Envision, but then we're like, hold my beer, I got this overlay idea, and they're like, no, let's just take the ball and throw it 15 lengths of the field, as opposed to actually getting some. We get 10 yards, but that's not good enough, because we want to get 8 touchdowns at once. And you're like, why do you think that's a good idea?
So I think we have some opportunities, and some in Porter Square, some in Harvard Square, some in Central Square. Definitely squeezing over toward the Somerville line now. I think these are real good opportunities.
Yep.
And I'll even say that, you know, the UTIL people with the early part of the Envision Cambridge before it kind of just sort of headed south, this is the way they were thinking too.
They know.
You know? They knew what they were talking about.
Because it's not just about, like, you know, rectangles and boxes and building a house, or going into West Cambridge and just paying whatever you feel like paying to put up. There are good places to build, easier places to build, and smarter places to build.
And then the bigger question.
Those areas aren't one of them.
Bigger question down the road, you know, we're not going to solve all the housing problems, by the way. Let's be clear about that.
Okay? I thought we were doing this to solve the problem.
Well, honestly, the more Cambridge thinks it can unilaterally solve it, the more pressure they're going to put on the Cambridge housing market.
Dumb with the argument.
So that every solution will actually create a greater problem. It is a Freakonomic show like none other, you know. It's sort of like I always say on the school side of things, the more we try and solve the achievement gap, the greater it grows.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes your attempt to solve the problem unilaterally results in the opposite of what you're
saying. I mean, no offense to my liberal neighbors and progressive types, but, like, you know, money doesn't solve all the problems.
That's right.
In fact, a lot of times it just makes things a lot worse.
Right.
And with achievement gap is one thing, but, like, you know, in the school system, or whether it be affordable housing or housing in general, like, you guys really overthink it. The more you clamp this down, the worse it has gotten.
That's really true.
And it's not because Cambridge is the best place on earth to live, though it's a great place to live, Cambridge. But, you know, if you make something scarce and you make it so incredibly difficult that only a handful of people can actually play in the game, then the values are always going to skyrocket.
That's
in every single housing policy that's come out of the council in the past 30 years or more has made housing more expensive.
Right.
Period.
So, just let some housing grow.
Yeah.
Good start, okay? You know, you don't have to overlay it all into existence. And another thing, too, which is probably the bigger, the other planning issue that I think is a hard nut to crack, but an important one, is transportation. Mm-hmm. And it ain't all bikes. you know, but it's getting the road network to work well for everybody, including bikes and pedestrians and hoverboarders and people riding around those single wheel. What do they call those things? It looks like a single wheel.
It's like an electric unicycle.
Like an electric unicycle.
Just looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
Shame alone prevents me from going on one.
Right. But, you know, it might also be people driving 40-year-old Volkswagen buses, too. But get the system to work reasonably well.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so you can pile people in. But the thing is, you still got to get people to move around. I did hear that the Red Line is actually finally on the verge of actually upgrading some of its rolling stock and signaling systems so that maybe we can actually get the necessary additional capacity.
Well, when Charlie Baker woke up one morning and ruined the tea, you know, it was a terrible thing that he did. And I'm glad that he's making amends.
I love the way political rhetoric goes.
So readeth the blogs.
Yeah, seriously. But anyway, you know, we do have some challenges for the incoming council and the incoming school committee. But
I just don't want to miss it. A friend of the neighborhood and somebody... totally gear shifting, sorry, but I want to make sure we didn't miss it, but the owner of Keezer's, Lenny
Goldstein,
super nice dude.
Yeah, really great guy.
Has passed away, and I didn't know that until you told me moments ago.
Yeah.
But I'm a little brokenhearted about it.
He was in addition to being a wonderful fellow to talk to, he was also the person who basically provided the tuxedos for a lot of Harvard students for a few generations. So I read about his obituary. It was actually in the Harvard Crimson.
Well, it's a bummer because I was talking, because he sold his building and, you know, Gerald bought it, but he... you know, Gerald let him stay for an extra year and a half because Len was having a hard time parting with the store. And if you went into Len's basement, it was tuxedos to the ceiling, like Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark.
So anyway, fare thee well.
Fare thee well, Ken.
Anyway, on that note, we'll be back another week or so on Cambridge Inside Out.
See you.